you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
I'm Austin Cross. Join me for LAist's new live event series with the James Beard Foundation. We Are Where We Eat will go behind the scenes of LA restaurants. The kickoff event is May 22nd. Tickets at LAist.com/events.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to be with you today after our NPR live coverage of more than 2.5 hours of the U.S. Supreme Court taking up the issue of to what extent, if at all, does a former president have immunity from prosecution for acts committed while that president was in office. This, of course, relates to former President Donald Trump and the special prosecutor's charges against him in efforts to overturn the most recent election. Joining us to talk about what was presented today to the justices is Professor of Law at George Mason University and the B. Kenneth Simon Chair in Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute, Ilya Soman. Professor Soman, good to have you with us again. Thank you so much for joining us. What struck you most about the back and forth we heard over the past 2.5 hours?
I think what struck me is first, there is little, if any, support among the justices for Trump's claims of near absolute immunity. On the other hand, there is some uncertainty among them about the question of what, if any, quote unquote, official acts do get at least some immunity. So it's possible we'll get a decision outlining some types of immunity for the president. And it's also possible there could be a remand to further analyze some of these issues in the lower courts.
What's your sense of how murky it is between what is an official act and what is a private act? Or is that something that's not too difficult to delineate?
I think there are going to be cases where it's easy and other cases where it might be hard. It was notable to me that in a couple of instances, the justices asked Trump's lawyer whether a whole bunch of acts alleged in the indictments against him qualify as official acts, and he had to concede that many of them were private acts, almost all of them, in fact, for example, acts related to creating fake slates of electors to try to substitute for the real ones and some other things as well. So I'm guardedly optimistic that the court might well rule that a lot of what is alleged against Trump in the indictment is actually a private act, but there might be some things where it's more debatable, and the whole issue of exactly where the line is, that can be a hard question. There's also a hard question about whether and to what extent there is immunity for official acts to begin with.
We're talking with constitutional scholar Ilya Soman. He's at George Mason University as professor and also chair in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute, libertarian-minded think tank. Also joining us, criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor Megan Blanco. Ms. Blanco, good to have you with us. Your thoughts about the exchanges this morning?
Well, thank you so much for having me. I agree. I was very interested and surprised by some of the questions some of the justices presented to both sides concerning both the separation of official acts and non-official acts, but more importantly, questions geared towards distinguishing core acts from other types of official acts. I could see the decision going a lot of different ways and it having huge impacts both on Trump's current case as well as on other cases potentially involving past presidents going forward.
We heard a lot of hearkening back to Richard Nixon, the pardoning of a former President Nixon from potential criminal prosecution by Gerald Ford during his presidency, how we look on that now versus how much anger there was at former President Ford for providing that pardon. And what do you think, if anything, that shed light on about how we overall look at this issue of alleged wrongdoing by presidents in office?
Well, there's concern about, you know, the political motivation, and we hear that towards the end, especially. You know, are we going to have a Justice Department who maybe doesn't like the executive or doesn't like some of the political moves that the president is taking, and concern that that might be fodder for future prosecutions, and concern that if they don't grant some sort of immunity, whether it be distinguishing official acts from non-official acts, or maybe a ruling that is more more narrow than that, that they would be opening the floodgates to future prosecutions. And they don't want that. There is concern about utilizing the Justice Department for political gain. And we certainly heard the justices focusing on that angle towards the end. And that is an angle that Trump's team adopted early on, and that Trump himself has put forward when he's talking to the media. This is a political prosecution. They are going after me, not because of what I did, but because they don't like me as a person. And we saw the more conservative justices of the courts questioning the parties in a way that suggests maybe they're adopting some of those same concerns.
Professor Soman, as a practical matter, if the majority of the court decides that there needs to be more clarity about the allegations in the federal indictment against the former president, does that then send this almost certainly into a process that'll take longer than the presidential election season?
On exactly how they do that. If they say that this is just issues that can be decided in the course of a trial by the jury, or by sort of procedural rulings by the judge, then there need not be prolonged procedures on that. Similarly, if they just rule that most of what is alleged against Trump is really private acts and not official acts, and only a few charges or only a few factual allegations, you know, there needs to be further determination about whether they're official or not, then there need not be much of a holdup. On the other hand, if they do a remand where, you know, some large portion of the indictment has to be reconsidered to determine whether the issues involved are official acts or not, then that would be more likely to be delayed past the election. So I think a lot depends on exactly how the Supreme Court reasons its decision and what sort of remand they issue, if indeed there is a remand.
Professor Soman, we always appreciate you being with us. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. From George Mason University, Professor of Law Ilya Soman. He also chairs constitutional studies at the libertarian-minded Cato Institute. With us as well, criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor Megan Blanco. Ms. Blanco, before you go, I wanted to talk about the case in New York of Harvey Weinstein, where this morning the State Court of Appeals, the highest court there, overturned the convictions on sexual assault and rape of Harvey Weinstein there because of a number of actions taken by the judge, including the allowing of women who alleged behavior by Harvey Weinstein against them in incidents that were not directly related to what were the issues at trial in the case. That was allowed into his trial, and the jurors, of course, heard that as well. Share with us a little bit more specifically about why the 4-3 majority of that New York State court found that there were errors by the judge that should lead to a new trial should prosecutors decide to file new charges.
Sure. So the Supreme Court in the Weinstein case found that the trial judge, allowed the prosecutors to introduce testimony of other accusers. And we're not talking about accusers who were the victims of the charged crimes. Instead, what we were talking about were other women who, throughout their interactions with Mr. Weinstein, alleged that Mr. Weinstein also engaged in inappropriate illegal conduct with them. The problem with doing that is at some point, the jury starts looking at the history of Mr. Weinstein with these other women who he's never been on trial with. There's never been, you know, a finding by any court of any wrongdoing. But the jury is able to then look at those accusations and find that Mr. Weinstein had a propensity to engage in this conduct. And the court, I think, rightfully found that that was prejudicial to the point that it invalidated his conviction. And what we have in criminal law is some courts, like in California and federally, you are allowed in sex cases to introduce prior complainants, other women, other victims, to show propensity, to show that a person did these acts that we're accusing him of doing now. He did them before, because we say he did them before, and these women claim that they were victimized before. You can use that substantively against the defendant. New York does not have that same law. And they're much more limited in what the prosecution can do with that type of evidence. Typically in New York, what you can utilize it for is showing moto, showing habit, showing something different than the fact that the person acted in conformity with other acts that he may have taken in the past.
So given that California has a law that allows this kind of testimony to be introduced in sex crimes prosecutions, would there be any avenue for Weinstein's attorneys to appeal on similar grounds in California? Is there no avenue for that?
It's much tougher. So in California, the prosecution is allowed to utilize other victims of sexual crimes to show that a person acted in conformity. It can come in substantively. What we say as lawyers is it comes in for all purposes. But there are still limitations. You have to still comport and comply with the due process requirements and the due process protections. At some point, it can be the case that a prosecutor introduces too much evidence, what we call 1108 evidence or prior victim evidence against a defendant, such that it becomes a due process problem. When it becomes a due process problem, even if the prosecution is allowed to introduce it under the evidence code, once it becomes a due process problem and a person's due process rights are affected to the point that they did not receive a fair trial, the case can be overturned. So it is a much harder argument to make in California, but it's not one that cannot be made. The standard is just a little different here.
All right. And again, just to reiterate what I said at the outset, Harvey Weinstein is still going to be in custody because he was convicted of rape in Los Angeles 2 years after the New York trial and conviction occurred. 2022 was when he was convicted in California. And again, as we've just heard from Ms. Blanco, different rules of what can be brought into evidence apply here than in New York. In New York, his conviction overturned that 2020 conviction. Ms. Blanco, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Megan Blanco, criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor with us on Air Talk. It's Entertainment Thursday. We always look forward to the range of entertainment-oriented stories that we bring you this day of the week. And coming up, we'll talk about the history of the Laugh Track. We'll talk about the kids show Bluey, the animated series, which is incredibly popular, but its fans very concerned in recent weeks about the future of Bluey. And our TV Talk critics are here with us as well. We'll be back in just 1 minute.
Support for LAS comes from Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, returning with a season of outdoor summer repertory theater on its scenic stage in the woods of Topanga, with picnicking in the gardens before the show. A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, along with The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, and Tartuffe Born Again, set at a TV station in Baton Rouge. And for a contentious election year, Bernardo Cubría's The Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latin Vote. Tickets at theatricum.com. Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting American Mariachi by Jose Cruz Gonzalez. It's the 1970s and women can't be mariachis. Or can they? American Mariachi is a feel-good comedy about familia, amor, and tradición that will send your heart soaring and put a bounce in your step with a wave of vibrant, infectious live music. On stage through June 9th, tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. So glad to have you with us. The laugh track has come and gone over the history of television comedies. But did you know that it's widely believed to have started with a 1950 NBC sitcom titled The Hank McCune Show?
Is this your report card or the weather report from Siberia?
But Papa, I got an A in spelling.
But it says here you failed.
I know. There is no A in spelling. Oh. But Father, all day long the teacher made me stand in the corner.
Our kid stood in the corner so much he's got a triangular forehead.
That's the first series to be known to carry a laugh track. It was not filmed in front of a studio audience. Joining us to talk about the history of the last laugh track is Syracuse University professor of TV and popular culture, Robert Thompson. Bob, so good to have you with us again.
Oh, nice to be back again. Thanks.
What was the reaction in 1950 when the McCune Show introduced a laugh track? Did people just assume there was a live audience there? Did people understand right away that this was all sweetened as a part of the production?
Well, let's remember in 1950, probably less than 10% of the country had a television set. So most people weren't noticing one way or the other. But if you noticed in Hank McCune, first of all, pretty subtle, pretty laid back compared to laugh tracks we'd get later. And most of it seemed to be laughter coming from people actually in the room, which would have made some sense given the kind of self-reflexive nature of the Hank McCune Show. So I don't think people paid much attention one way or the other. Also, in 1950, most television was live, and a good chunk of it was shot before live audiences. And for 2.5 decades before that, that had been the case with radio. And before radio, people had been used to having laugh tracks in the actual spaces that they were. In a live theater, you could hear laugh track, whether it was a vaudeville show or the movies. So by the time we get to television in 1950, so much of American comedy depends upon the timing, if nothing else, that people laughing after each joke gives you. And therefore, rather than this being uncomfortable for them to hear, it would have, in fact, just the opposite. If jokes would have had zero response, that would have been what seemed weird.
And of course, yeah, with the boom of TV situation comedies in the 1960s, CBS just had an incredible slate of these series, including the Andy Griffith Show. We give you another example here as Opie Interrupts a Wedding.
I now pronounce you man.
I know why they shouldn't be married.
Opie, what are you trying to do?
I'm speaking now so I won't have to forever hold my peace.
I'm not supposed to speak.
Then why did he ask?
Well, it's just part of the ceremony, Opie. You always say speak, but nobody ever does.
Well, I'm gonna. What did she have to marry him for anyway?
That's from the Andy Griffith Show of the 1960s. And one of the things, you know, as a kid who watched a lot of those shows growing up, Bob, the laugh tracks were so often the same, you could recognize the laugh tracks. They were clearly identifiable as being run over and over again.
It's true. And there was something of Charlie Douglas is the guy who's generally considered to be the father of the laugh track. And I'm sure he wasn't the first person to supply disengaged laughter to a program. But he did have control over the industry for a while. And he had a finite number of elements, just like a piano keyboard has 88 keys. He had whatever, 320 different elements of laughter and titter and that kind of thing. And they often went in the same order, even though they'd lay upon one another. So you could, if you were a real couch potato back then, and if you were paying attention to such a thing, which nobody was, you could actually begin to notice the particular laugh sequences, Charles Douglas as auteur in laughter. But you notice how with the Andy Griffith Show, how laid back that laughter is.
Yeah.
It's there for timing, but it's really subtle. And of course, because those shows weren't theatrical, you didn't want to make too much of them because they didn't really make any sense. An episode of Bewitched or an episode of I Dream of Jeannie, the laughter made little sense. Oh, my favorite example, The Love Boat. This is a little later, mid-1970s. that had a pretty aggressive laugh track. And when you think about it, this was taking place on a cruise ship in the middle of the Caribbean. Where were these people who were laughing? They would have had been on lifeboats surrounding the ship.
That was a show that needed an aggressive laugh track, though, because it wasn't coming naturally. We're talking with our guest, Syracuse University professor Bob Thompson. He's professor of television and popular culture. So, Bob, what's the first example of a TV comedy that went without a laugh track? And I assume, you know, this was part of its fame. What was the first one that we've been able to document?
Well, the big movement, I mean, we started to get, and, you know, there had been comedies before, right from the beginning, that weren't shot in front of studio audiences and that were without laugh tracks. So really, right from the start, we had that. Then it became much more commonplace. But there were a few real moments. In 1980, Larry Gelbart, who created the TV version of MASH, it was based on a book and a movie, but the TV version he created, and he argued constantly with CBS. He didn't want a laugh track on MASH. CBS insisted that they have one, and CBS won that battle. Anyway, Larry Gelbart then in 1980 gets a television deal, and I think it was with NBC, for a show called United States, which he claimed was going to do for marriage what MASH did for war. And he got the deal that he wouldn't do it with a laugh track. Needless to say, it wasn't as famous or as successful as MASH. They made 13 episodes. They canceled it and pulled it off the air after 9. And I have seen those episodes, and I really believe that had they included a laugh track, it would have done a lot better than it did. It still wouldn't have been a hit, but it would have done better than it did. It needed a laugh track. And I think most of the time, so did MASH. Not because MASH wasn't well written, but the setup, punchline kind of joke depends upon a live audience, because that's where that comic tradition comes from.
There were shows, of course, you mentioned, shot in front of a live audience, most famously I Love Lucy and others. But let's listen to this clip from Seinfeld. Hear Kramer and the gang rehearse his one line in a new Woody Allen film.
And I'm sitting there with Woody, and I say, I turn to him and I go, boy, these pretzels are making me thirsty.
Is that how you're going to say it?
No, no, I'm working on it.
Do it like this. These pretzels are making me thirsty.
These pretzels are making me thirsty. No, no, see, that's no good. See, you don't know how to act.
These pretzels are making me thirsty!
So there we have a live audience, but how much sweetening takes place, Bob, in the multi-camera on-stage comedy shows like this?
Well, it depends on the producer who's in charge of the show, and it depends on the audience and how much they need to be fixed up. Sweetening, of course, means you fix it up. You boost it where it needs boosting. You bring it down where it needs bringing down. You add an awe or a groan or whatever if the audience didn't provide it. Some showrunners are very stubborn about trying to keep things pretty much the way they went down. But if you've got, and sometimes the conditions, anybody who's been to a taping of a comedy knows that sometimes you're not just there for the 23 minutes it takes to tape it. You could be there for a long time, and they need the continuity as they're cutting between performances and stuff to add those kinds of things. You know, it just occurred to me, again, that was pretty understated laugh track there. One could argue before Charlie Douglas and his little laugh keyboard box, before any of this, you already had laugh tracks in some ways provided, not just because you had a live audience, but producers were always stacking the deck. Milton Berle's mother was well known to be in every performance of the Milton Berle show, and she would laugh hysterically. He would refer to it every now and again. If you watch the very first episode of the TV version of George Burns and Gracie Allen show, they have a plant there who is laughing way too hard and way too hysterically over jokes that certainly don't deserve that kind of response.
Well, and then with Gracie Allen, who needs to be paying someone to laugh hard? She's so funny.
That's a good point. But they've been around for a long time. They were using some of their old material on television that they hadn't done on radio. But, you know, all of this. So it wasn't until I mentioned that 1980 thing, but that didn't work. And it gave network executives a reason to say we need these laugh tracks. Then, if anybody remembers the late 1980s, 1988, 89 season, around there, all of a sudden it became very fashionable for serious, artistic kind of comedy to completely get rid of the laugh track. They were associating that with the old TV cheesy kind of days. And we had a show called Frank's Place, took place in New Orleans.
Yeah.
Hooperman, Slap Maxwell Story, Sledgehammer. And then after that, in mid-season, The Wonder Years, which became a big hit, was rebooted not long ago. And a show called The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd, which critics liked, viewers not so much. So, and back then they even gave them a different name. They called them dramedies.
Yeah.
Now we simply call them single camera comedies.
Bob, you are such a font of fascinating information about all things television. I could talk with you for hours. It sounds like you're generally in defense of the laugh track, that you believe it has a place.
I do. I think it's very important. Now, don't get me wrong. I don't think when you're doing the kind of comedy like a series like Atlanta or Insecure or, you know, some of these wonderful, really, really good comedies that have been done, you would never put a laugh track in that. It would be really ridiculous. It would be absurd. But when you're working in that tradition of live comedy that essentially a sitcom is, even if it, you know, if you're doing the three camera, you're doing it in front of an audience. Those kinds of comic traditions depend upon an audience providing some of the timing. Audience reaction, orally anyway, is really important. And I think there have been times, if you were to edit out the laughter in classic shows like I Love Lucy or Cheers even, or any of those shows, you would find them very alarming. It would be like all those jokes were simply dying up. Even MASH, I would go so far, and Larry Gelbart and I used to go back and forth on this. I think MASH was a better show with that laugh track. If they wanted no laugh track, they shouldn't have written it sitcom style. They should have written it film comedy style.
I'm just picturing you debating, having interviewed Gelbart a few times over the years, you debating with, because he was a fun guy to talk with. As are you, Bob. As always, thank you so much for joining us and talking about the history and evolution of the laugh track.
That was so much fun. Thank you.
I enjoyed a professor of TV and popular culture at Syracuse University, Robert Thompson. Coming up, the highly popular Australia-produced children's show Bluey, and there's concern about what the future of Bluey might hold. I must tell you, I've watched now multiple episodes in preparation. I get what all the excitement is about the series. It's extremely well done. We'll talk about why it has such great appeal when we come back in 1 minute.
Support for LAS comes from Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, returning with a season of outdoor summer repertory theater on its scenic stage in the woods of Topanga, with picnicking in the gardens before the show. A Midsummer Night's Dream is back, along with The Winter's Tale, Wendy's Peter Pan, and Tartuffe Born Again, set at a TV station in Baton Rouge. And for a contentious election year, Bernardo Cubrias, The Hispanic, Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latin Vote. Tickets at theatricum.com. Support for LAS comes from Latino Theater Company at the Los Angeles Theater Center, presenting the world premiere of Mix Mix, the Filipino Adventures of a German Jewish Boy by Boney B. Alvarez. Inspired by true events from the life of Ralph Price, after escaping Nazi Germany, a newfound tropical refuge in the Philippines is upended when Japan invades the islands. On stage through June 16th. Tickets and information at latinotheaterco.org.
You're listening to the theme song of the very popular children's animated series Bluey, the Australian-produced show. It's had a number of rumors flying about the future of the Heelers. That's the family of Australian cattle dogs depicted in this series. The show was co-commissioned by Australian Broadcasting and BBC Studios and streams on Disney Plus. Not only are kids fans, but adults as well. Most of the episodes are fewer than 10 minutes in length. But a 28-minute episode dropped a week and a half ago titled The Sign, and it began the question of whether the end was near for Bluey. Let's listen to this clip from The Sign.
Come on, get in Bobo. We'll check her flat first.
What's Bobo? It's the name of our car. There's no room for me.
Oh no, Bobo's full.
You'll have to stay here.
Oh, what? This is the worst day of all my life.
Bluey, you'll have to sit in the front seat.
What?
The front seat? Really?
Is that allowed? Queensland road rules say that if all the seats are taken, a child older than four can sit in the front seat. Yep, it's allowed. Come on, get in.
This is the best day of all my life.
Well, glad someone's having fun.
Warning, though, they did get pulled over later, although it was the highway patrol officer who realized he was in the wrong. Joining us to talk about Bluey and the series' future is TV critic for Vulture and Bluey connoisseur herself, Catherine Van Arendonk. Catherine, so good to have you with us. I had never seen an episode of Bluey. My wife is a speech pathologist who works with kids, so she is very familiar with it. I'd never seen it. I watched the episodes that you recommended for me, as well as the three most recent episodes. I see what all the fun is about and why parents like it as well. What are the reasons that you think this is an important series?
Yeah, I mean, I'm so glad to hear that you liked it. I truly love converting people to Bluey. but it's also not a difficult thing to do in my experience. It is an Australian kids show, as you mentioned. It's about this family of dogs. And generally, a Bluey episode is about a game that these two sisters are playing with each other. Sometimes it's like a very simple game, like they threw something sticky to the ceiling and they're waiting for it to fall. Sometimes it's a much more elaborate game and it's like, you know, some fantasy world that they have created. But the game then usually becomes a door that opens to other kinds of themes and ideas and stories that Bluey wants to explore about childhood, often about parenthood and parenting. And I think one of the big appeals for parents in particular is that it represents this sense of playfulness from a parent, but also the exhaustion of parenting, the challenges of parenting, the really beautiful things about being a parent. And it is very, very good at reminding parents what it feels like to be a child. And I think for kids, you know, they love the games. They love it. Is very funny, very silly show. But then it also has these moments that are much more emotional. And there are these opportunities to sort of see your parents as people in a way that a lot of children's shows don't really present. And so I find it very easy to convert even skeptical adults to Bluey fans.
Well, and there's so many kids shows that as we were raising our son that I took to as well, that Phineas and Ferb, I think I was more into than our son. so there's certain series that parents really gravitate to. So Catherine, the concern with this, first of all, it's a 28-minute episode, which all the others prior had been very short. So you get nearly a half hour here. And then the theme of The Sign is the question of whether the family is going to be moving. And you've got, other things that come in this episode. I don't want to spoil it. But what's your understanding of whether the series will continue?
Yeah, I mean, this is the huge question among, I think, both Bluey fans, kids and parents, but also for like several very important giant media companies, particularly Disney and BBC Studios, because Bluey is not just a great show. It is also insanely popular. It is often the most streamed series in the world, like including all children's programs and adult programs. And so it is this huge business for Disney and for BBC and for Ludo Studios, the production company that makes it. But at the same time, The Sign was made there's a copyright at the end of it. It was finished in 2021, probably more like mid 2022. They actually would have finished production on it. And there has been no evidence. There's been no like a big season four renewal announcement. There's been no evidence that they are in the process of making more Bluey right now, which means it has been several years since Bluey was in production, as far as anyone knows. Again, there's like rampant, very excited speculation about this. But the combination of that and the very sort of final gestures that the sign is about, it's not just this moving question, it's also full of all these callbacks and these lovely references to previous beloved Bluey episodes, little themes, little characters that they kind of, you know, pull together at the end. It feels like a big ending gesture. And that combined with the sort of lack of production that people know about, as well as the fact that the creator, who is a guy named Joe Brum, has said things in the past about his concern about keeping the show on too long and then not being able to live up to previous seasons, about the voice actors aging. Together, there it creates this picture where it really does feel like the future of the show is far from certain.
Yeah. Catherine, thank you so much for talking about the tremendous popularity of Bluey, the most minute streamed program, streaming not just here but around the world. Catherine Van Arendonk, TV critic for Vulture and an expert on Bluey. Thank you so much. Let's transition to our other TV critics joining us this week. Eric Deggans with us, NPR TV critic and media analyst, and Kristen Baldwin, TV critic for Entertainment Weekly. Up first, thank you. Good night. The Bon Jovi story. Gautam Chopra is the director of this documentary biographical four-part series that's out tomorrow. Eric, what did you think of it?
Well, I thought it was really interesting. I have to sort of note that I was a music critic in New Jersey in the mid-1990s, and I covered Bon Jovi. The paper I worked for, the Asbury Park Press, was his hometown paper. And so I got to know him a little bit. I interviewed him several times. He introduced me to the governor of New Jersey then. Wow. At the backstage at a charity concert, you know. So I was kind of familiar with the story, and I kind of know a little bit about John. So what was interesting about this was that, number one, they're very honest about the fact that John Bon Jovi was struggling with singing. Just a few years ago, back in 2022, he was performing at concerts. The band was thinking about doing something for its 40th anniversary, and he was really struggling. And I remember seeing videos online where he was struggling and hitting bad notes and stuff. And so we get to see him trying all kinds of treatments, from lasers to acupuncture, and then eventually a solution that works. I won't reveal what happens, but that is woven throughout four episodes that tell you about the band's history, from playing clubs in New Jersey to million selling records, to having to let go of their bass player, to having guitarist Richie Sambora quit while they were in the middle of a tour, and then being inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and what comes through is that, you know, John has always wanted to have respect for the band and its accomplishments, and sometimes they've had to fight for that. And what also comes through is his ability to steer the band through so many changes in music, so many different eras, and somehow keep them as successful as possible. And, you know, that's a really admirable story. And so I think fans of the band will really like this. Four episodes is a lot if you're not a Bon Jovi fan. I'd recommend yeah. just watching the first and last episode.
We're talking about Thank You, Good Night, The Bon Jovi Story. It's streaming on Hulu, a four-part music docuseries about the band, and Gautam Chopra is the director of it. The four parts release tomorrow. Under the Bridge, also streaming on Hulu. It's based on true events, the story of a 14-year-old girl who went to join friends at a party and never returned home. The miniseries stars Lily Gladstone, the Oscar nominee, and Riley Keough. Quinn Shepherd is the creator of the three-episode series, or I should say 8 episodes total will be out. 3 are currently available. Kristen, what do you think of Under the Bridge?
Well, I think I had a mixed reaction to it. So, yes, it's about the 1997 murder of a 14-year-old Canadian girl named Rena Virk by a group of teenagers. And this murder made national news, and it became the subject of author Rebecca Gottfried's acclaimed literary book, nonfiction book, Under the Bridge. And that's what this is based on. Hulu actually bases the adaptation, or sets the adaptation, from the point of view of Rebecca Gottfried, played by Riley Keough, as she gets to know the kids involved, as well as Rena's family. And Lily Gladstone plays a cop who is also investigating Rena's death. And unfortunately, Quinn Shepherd, who you mentioned, adapted it for the screen. She kind of throws in too many half-formed plots that really dilute the main powerful narrative, which is about these sad, mad, lonely kids channeling their pain into violence. But I will say, the young cast gives some excellent performances. Vritika Gupta, who plays Rena, is fantastic. Chloe Goodry plays Rena's tough-talking, John Gotti-obsessed frenemy named Josephine. And Euphoria's Javon Walton, who people may remember as Ashtray on Euphoria, may he rest in peace, he plays Warren, a neglected kid who makes an impulsive decision that changes his life. So while I didn't love it, I was really impressed by these kids and their performances. They really moved me.
Under the Bridge is streaming on Hulu. The miniseries is a total of 8 episodes, 3 of them currently available. Conan O'Brien Must Go is a series that's streaming on Max, and it's O'Brien's conversations with people that he meets through his podcast, Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend. Mike Sweeney directs the 4-episode series. All of them are currently available. Eric, what did you think?
I really love this, and I did a review of it for NPR last week where I talked about how it points the way forward for former late-night talk show hosts who may find themselves kind of kicked out of the genre as it contracts, because we've seen fewer people watching late-night TV shows. We've seen some shows go away. And Conan O'Brien left the late-night talk show game a few years ago, but he has taken his quirky brand of comedy and turned it into a series of podcasts. He's helped produce other comic specials, and now he has this travel special where he goes to visit fans that he met on a podcast about his fans, and he kind of, in some cases, surprises them. He goes over to Norway, surprises a fan, and then winds up singing on the guy. The guy's a musical artist. He winds up singing on the guy's song and performing with him live. Mm-hmm. And O'Brien just has this way of sort of, he's almost like the world's most accomplished class clown. He is constantly trying to get the people around him to laugh, and he'll do anything. He'll commit entirely to a bit. And he finds all these inventive ways to wring comedy out of visiting fans in Norway and Thailand and other Ireland, other places. I just thought it was a really wonderful series that had a surprising amount of heart, but really was a great showcase for what a great comedy mind can do when he's freed from the shackles of sitting behind a desk and talking to celebrities about what movie they're going to star in next week.
Yeah, it's such a great point, Eric, because he has total freedom creativity in a format like this. You don't have that kind of creative control, even if you've got clout as a late night host, because there are constraints of the format itself. Kristen, what did you think of Conan O'Brien Must Go?
I mean, I just love him, and I always loved his specials, that on TBS, this is sort of an offshoot of those specials, Conan Abroad. And what I love about the specials, everything Eric said, but also, like, He is such a curious guy. And in addition to, you know, trying to make everybody's laugh, he really does have a genuine curiosity about these cultures. And, you know, it really tries to embrace, he tries local activities like Muay Thai kickboxing, and he acts on an Irish soap opera and things like that. But he really, it's heartwarming and kind of sweet to see how he makes comedy while also showing that, you know, the commonality of we can be from different countries, but we can connect with humor and with enthusiasm. And, you know, it's just a really nice thing and a series of episodes to watch in a time when, you know, we can feel very the culture can feel very antagonistic.
All four of the episodes of Conan O'Brien Must Go are now streaming on Max. Velma is starting its second season, also streaming on Max. This is the adult animated comedy series with the origin story of Velma Dinkley of the Scooby-Doo Mystery Gang. Charlie Grandy is the creator of the series. Eric, what do you think of the second episode, second season?
So when this show first debuted a while ago, it was some critics called it the most hated new show on television at the time.
Wow.
What it does is it takes some of the characters from the Scooby-Doo world and places them in a situation that's very adult. The supernatural things that happen can be bloody and very explicit, and they also explicitly talk about sex and things like that. And, you know, a lot of people very rightfully said, you know, who wanted this from Scooby-Doo characters? And so I watched a couple of episodes from the second season to see if it had gotten any better. And unfortunately, it has not. And I think one reason why I have a lot of problems with this show is because not only are the characters, most of them, unlikable, but they don't really give you a reason to care about the characters. I can watch unlikable characters if they're compelling, mm-hmm. but a lot of the humor in this show kind of fell flat with me. And I really had a hard time sort of arguing with myself for why I should even be watching it. And so again, I'm constantly wondering, like, why did they bother making this show? But apparently enough people watched it that they, you know, made another season of it. So there you go.
We're talking about the animated series Velma, second season on Max, episodes premiering today. There will be a total of 10 episodes. The Jinx Part 2 follows the 2015 series The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst, which helped convict Durst for the killing of his first wife, his best friend, and his neighbor. Part 2 overlaps with the first. Andrew Jarecki is back heading up this true crime documentary series. There'll be a total of 6 episodes. The first premiered last Sunday. Eric, what do you think of Part 2 of The Jinx?
Well, this is another, you know, and I hate to sound like Zelig here, but I interviewed Andrew Jarecki before the first installment of The Jinx came out. And he told me at the time that, yes, it's a true crime docuseries, and we solve the crime by the end of it. Now, at the time, you know, Robert Durst was this wealthy descendant of a real estate family, and he had been accused of 3 murders, but no one had ever really been able to resolve them or get him charged with them. And so, you know, Jarecki telling me that, I was like, wow. And people may remember that's what happened. They played part of an interview. They were interviewing Robert Durst, and then he went to the bathroom, and he seemed to admit to the murders when he was in the bathroom, and he had left his microphone on, and they had recorded it. So what we see in the part two is that it picks up right when Durst got arrested by the police right before that last episode aired. We're told in this new docuseries that the police were aware of what was coming in that final episode, and they were afraid that Durst was going to leave the country once it aired and they had his confession in there, or what seemed to be a confession in there. And so it opens, the new season opens with a phone call that Durst makes to his attorney after he's been arrested, talking about how worried he is about what's happening. And then what we see is all the people who were friends with this, you know, very wealthy guy who may have helped him avoid responsibility for these murders for years and seemed to continue to support him even after he was arrested and charged with murder. He eventually was convicted and died in prison. And so this docuseries didn't have quite the impact of the original Jinx because so much of what it tells us, you know, we know that Robert Durst has died. We know he died in prison. And so there's kind of an ending to the story already that's known. But it is still interesting to watch how he drew these people into his web and used them to support himself and in ways that may be surprising to folks who don't know the story.
You were mentioning about interviewing Andrew Jarecki for the first series. Susan Berman, who's one of the people that Durst was alleged to have killed, she was a guest on our program because she was an expert on Vegas. Her dad had been a mobster. She'd written about her experiences. She's a terrific guest and very tragic when we heard about her being stabbed in her home. And then, of course, Durst prosecuted later. We're talking about The Jinx, Part 2, this follow-up to Andrew Jarecki's The Jinx, The Life and Deaths of Robert Durst. It's rated TV-14. The first episode is out. We should talk about Shogun, which is one of the most popular series on FX and streaming on Hulu. We've got the season finale of the critically acclaimed show, an adaptation of the James Clavell novel. Kristen, what do you think of Shogun?
Well, I loved it. I was able to watch all of it at once, you know, for review screeners, which was helpful because it's very, you know, this is a very sort of complex story about an Englishman who stumbles into a power struggle in feudal Japan. So you really have to pay close attention. It's not one of those that you can watch while like folding your laundry. But I will say that, not to spoil it for anyone who hasn't had a chance to watch the finale yet, but it really takes the time to honor each of these core characters with notable and satisfying endings. And like the rest of the series, the finale, the conclusion of the story, you know, blends action and intrigue and a lot of emotion and humor. I just am beating the drum now, as are many critics, for Hiroyuki Sanada, who played Lord Kurunaga, and Tadanobu Asano, who played Yabushugi, and Anna Sawai, who starred as Mariko. They all need to be in the Emmys mix later this summer. Like, we need to have this happen.
Kristen, thanks so much for talking about the season finale of Shogun. Thank you so much for joining us for this edition of Air Talk. NPR's Here and Now comes up next. I'll be with you tomorrow morning at 10 for Film Week following Austin Cross on Air Talk.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.